Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Michael and Patty Show, a no-fluff, real-talk podcast where powerhouse Patty and I dive into the weird, wild, and wonderful world of PEI real estate with a side of laughs and storytelling. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning, Michael.
I would also like to thank my assistant, ChatGTP, for creating that intro that I didn't even ask for.
And I think it's ChatGPT.
GPT? I'm yes. Probably thinking of the Pontiac GTP.
Yes, yes.
Excellent car in its day. Today, it is, what, the beginning of April, and whitecaps are in front of us. It's a stormy, nasty day here in Atlantic Canada.
Yeah, you would not know it is spring by the looks of it with the freezing rain outside. And
it's all because we've both had our cars detailed, washed away the winter filth, and put the all-season tires on.
Yeah, I did my all seasons, yes, and now I have to drive today in icy, bad weather conditions.
All the way to Stanley Bridge.
Yes, that's where I'll be going.
Remember I told you that I felt that prices were just completely out of hand in Canada, and it just seemed like the price of a house was far, far higher in relativity to what a person makes.
I do remember. This was something off and on that you and I have discussed over the years. I just didn't realize how bad the numbers were.
Well, the numbers are pretty bad. In a study that Harvard University did, they were comparing U.S. against Canadian house prices. We're not going to get into the U.S. side, other than it is more affordable to live in the U.S. When we look at house prices in Canada, in 1980, the average home price was about $67,000. And the median household income was about $21,000. So basically, it cost you triple what you made to buy a house. The price-to-income ratio is 3.2.
Mm.
Those are the prices I kind of remember. You know, I bought my house in my first house in my 20s. I think you did the same.
Yes.
My house was bigger, though.
Of course it was, Michael.
My house could probably fit in one of your closets, and it was so small. My house was so small, we had to go outside to change our minds.
That's pretty funny.
Of course, today you got these micro condos in the big cities that, you know, you have to sleep on your kitchen table. 1990, we go up to 3.4. Year 2000, 3.5. So things are pretty reasonable to year 2000. And then 2010, average home price, $339,000 approximately. Median income, $57,000. Price to income ratio, almost 6% at 5.9. That's huge.
It almost doubled.
Well, it did double. You round them off. It cost me three times my income, household income, to buy a house in 80. In 2010, it cost me almost six times. In 2020, average house price, $566,000. Median household income, $84,000. Price to income ratio, 6.7.
That's a little scary. You wonder how some of the younger generations of the younger kids are going to be able to enter into the home ownership world.
When I bought my first house, which was the equivalent of a size of an RV, it cost me 0.5% or 0.5 of what I was making that year.
Huh.
So I made twice as much that year to pay for that house cash. I didn't, of course, because I mortgaged it. Because why wouldn't you at whatever percentage rate invest the money into something else that's going to give you a better return? But do you remember what your ratio was, household?
Mine was about the three.
Was it?
Yes.
Okay. Moving along here, if you are looking for more information on PEI or PEI real estate, and you know, be sure to check out our YouTube channels, Twitter feeds, Instagram, threads, newsletter, gov.pe.ca and PEI Play. And most importantly, I'm sure you agree with this, is my website under the links tab at the top right. There's a whole list of mapping tools, tools to set up a real-time search, all kinds of stuff there. Do you have that on your website? No. There's nothing there.
Whole bunch of drop-down options to educate and inform yourself of what the buying and selling process would look like.
So check out both websites. These links on our websites are just not something thrown together. They are a compilation of links that we used to research pretty well every day and there's all kinds of good stuff there. So check that out. Patty's YouTube channel, it's growing, 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 and she is up to about 700 subscribers, right?
Yeah, over 700, 722 or 23 the last time I looked.
Which is pretty well every hour.
I did not
look. Did you check this morning?
No, I did not.
Well, you're going to have to get on that. So in order to be the main thing on YouTube is in order to monetize or make your channel stand out or make it substantive, you have to get to that 1,000 subscribers. Not that your YouTube channel is going to be an income producer in real estate and PEI, because it's not. But she only needs just under 300 subscribers to get to 1,000. So what you need to do is go to my YouTube channel and make sure you subscribe to it. And then you can go to Patty's.
Why, thank you, Michael, for the little plug promotion. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Most of the stuff on this show, in fact, pretty well all of it, is stuff that comes from conversations, experiences, transactions, and emails that come across your desk. And some of the most entertaining ones are those coming from newer brokerages trying to solicit me or Patty to become agents with their office. So recently we got this rather humorous email that was going to offer us a 90 or 95% split if we're to join their office, which has the added bonus, it's a virtual office. Yes. So when I looked at this, I thought to myself, so the way the splits work is when an agent earns a commission, the office gets a percentage, which is usually anywhere from 5 to 50% of the gross income. And in this particular case, they're offering pretty well all of that. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking to myself as a business person, if I'm an agent, particularly a new agent, because it's not going to be the old decrepit agents like myself or Patty that are going to join a brand new brokerage. We're pretty well got our feet concreted in at the brokerages we're with, and there's a good reason for that. But as a new agent, you have to ask yourself, if the broker's only taking 5%, what are they using to market the firm with? What are they using to educate their agents with? What are they going to be using to fight all the lawsuits because the agents don't have any education? The math doesn't add up. And then I further that by thinking, well, if you were going to do this and you're going to join Acme Realty with their virtual office, which is just another way of saying we can't afford an office because we have no income because we're giving the agents 95% of the commission, the gross, you have to ask yourself, why wouldn't I just become a broker myself and get 100% split? And I still have no office and no education.
And that is why you do see, and I don't know for the rest of Canada. However, on Prince Edward Island, there are many little micro brokerages, if you will, opening up all over the island. They feel this is something that is an easy thing to do. And in some ways it is. However, there is a level of accountability and there's a little more to it than just opening up a brokerage and taking 100% because there's government requirements that you have to also do. But I agree along with you. First of all, no one's soliciting me, just for clarity.
You've been taken off the list. They probably know that you're a bad egg and you're going to cause turmoil in their virtual office.
It's because I am the broker at my office. So I am off everyone's list now, unfortunately. Although I do love my office. I love my team. I love what I do. And I love running it at a high level. High level, which is the things that you've said. Education is so important for a brokerage. And again, if you are not getting the amount of money that, I mean, people feel they're coming from a place of scarcity, so I want the most amount of my commission split. But what are you willing to sacrifice and give up in order to get a higher commission split? Are you giving up the services of having staff, administration staff, inputting your listings, sending files off to the lawyers? If you're the client listening to this, please know, if you have a one-man show realtor, hopefully they're able to service take care of you and not drop the ball, I mean, you might be their only sale or only listing, and that's fine. You'll get exceptional, hopefully, service. But you want to make sure you are in a system, which you would be if you're working with a brokerage. It's not just the agent. You're working with the brokerage. Is this brokerage, is this agent trained? Do they have the, you know, credentials or the accreditations? Do they have staff that's going to be looking after it? And also branding is the other thing that's just top of mind, you know, with me. If you're a realtor looking for a home, if you will, to hang your license with, what is the reputation of that particular company? What is their brand? What are they known for? These are all things that you should take into consideration.
What's the reputation of the broker?
The brokerage, correct.
Well, the broker and the brokerage are two different things. The brokerage, if it was a name brand per se, would have one reputation, and then the broker, him or herself, would have another reputation, especially in a place like Prince Edward Island, not so much in Toronto or Vancouver or New York, but everybody knows everybody here. So the bottom line is, if you're a new agent and you're getting these emails and you think there's prosperity in getting 95% of nothing rather than 50% of something, you may consider something other than just the split.
Yeah, and check their sales stats, particularly like we have down here, Michael. The brokers are the principal owner. If they are in the top 20 of realtor earning incomes on the island, and it's not something that's advertised or promoted.
Are you talking their individual sales or the brokerage's sales? Because they're two different things.
The individual sales. If they're in the top 20, 30, how much of the business that's coming into the office is actually being distributed amongst the agents?
If you've got a brokerage with a broker that's in the top 20 agents, chances are that broker's focus is on making him or herself some money, not taking care of the other agents in that brokerage. If you've got a broker that doesn't have sales, but the brokerage is doing phenomenal and it's in the top 5 or 10, let's say, now you know the focus is on the agents.
Would
that be a fair assumption?
Yeah, and I would say the top 10, because there's over 40 offices on Prince Edward Island. So if a brokerage is in the top 10, because the top five, you got all your top brands.
Let's meet halfway. Okay. Top 11. Let's move on. If anyone hasn't checked out Google Earth Desktop Pro, you need to revisit it. I have done so over the past few years. It was pretty rudimentary and basic to begin with, but they're really making some strides. And what you can do with that tool in Prince Edward Island is absolutely amazing. Check the box for 3D buildings on your left, topology. It is a great way to see the island and, of course, the whole world. Have you been using Google Earth Desktop Pro? Not to be confused with Google Earth Desktop. This is the pro version.
No, and I know
you know what the difference is?
No, and that's what I'm going to ask you.
The word pro is on the screen now.
Is that really the only difference in the software?
I have no idea. All I know is you should check it out. It's free. It looks amazing. And it's just one more tool in our arsenal of mapping utilities, in addition to the ones on both of our websites that you want to check out. In fact, we should add that to our link list as well.
We probably should. So I know you had taken a course, or were taking a course to make sure, because this is something that Michael does. As soon as he learns or knows of something new, he has to sign himself up for an education or training course to really become a master and know how to use it. And sometimes make sure he understands or knows all the shortcuts, so he looks really, really efficient. So the course, did you take a training course on Google Earth?
I just did a 1-hour sort of seminar on it.
Okay.
And I just wanted to learn enough to know if this is a tool today, if it would be a good tool to use looking at PEI real estate. It absolutely is. The only thing it doesn't have, which would be super duper, which you're probably never going to see, is the property lines, which you see on our tools, on our websites. You can actually draw the property lines are drawn for you, which is probably a number one on the list of things you want to see when you're looking at real estate and PEI. Google Earth will not do that, to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah, but a side note to that, whether it's the government site or the agricultural site, they do have a disclaimer at the bottom that they are approximate lines and not to replace having a survey or some document, a plot plan like that. So they're just an approximation of where...
All mapping has a disclaimer on it.
100%.
And that's why it shouldn't be affixed to purchase and sale agreements like it's some sort of legal document, because it's not. It says right on it, it's not. But that's a different subject. Getting on to another subject, you're always running into something stupid. I should say silly. Stupid and silly. You ran into a situation where the listing agent said, we want the title search done right away so we can clear all the conditions on the offer. That has to be one of the dumbest things I think I've heard in years.
Yes.
So what the agent, first of all, when an agent says we, who's we? Is there more than one of you? Is there a group of you? Is there more than one person on this call? We have nothing to do with it. What does the vendor want and what was the vendor advised? So the title search, maybe you can tell us what it is and why you wouldn't want to do that right away.
Title search is considered a non-condition, but yet it's a condition. So you remove all your conditions, financing, home inspection, insurance, septic inspection. Once all those conditions have been removed, the property is considered sold. Title search is not one of those conditions that the bank acknowledges or recognizes as, we need this removed in order for this deal to be considered firm. Title search, best practice, and what lawyers request and what should be done is completed approximately a week or two prior to closing. And what title search is looking for is to make sure that there's nobody's names that are on the registry or the deed for that property that hasn't been removed. Could have been someone that passed away or sloppy paperwork, perhaps. I mean, lawyers are human. Even people that work at the registry office, I've seen situations where a name was supposed to be or a deed was supposed to be filed or a document removing a mortgage, and it never got done on the online version and it was still sitting on the desk. So a lawyer is to go in and make sure that all the documentation reconciles, every mortgage presents as it's been satisfied, no names that shouldn't appear on the deed. And it goes back to the lifetime of this property is typically what they do, as well as no liens on it. If you were to have your title search done a month or 2 months prior to your closing date, the date that you do your final walkthrough and end up essentially getting your keys, you're leaving that property open or susceptible to a service provider, whether, say, it's a new septic or the windows guy or, you know, house maintenance or some repairs that were done, to file a lien against that property. And once that property exchanges hands, you also just acquired the lien for the property, in which you would end up having to go, you know, get a lawyer, file a claim, trying to chase them down to see if you can be compensated. But essentially, you don't have clear title because there's a lien on it.
What they do is a title search. A title search basically checks the chain of title, which basically means that from day one, from the first deed being filed, that all liens are free, everybody has signed off, the deeds are consistent in that the purchaser's lawyer usually recreates the deed, so the deed reflects actually what the property is in the past that hasn't been modified. But by saying we want the title search removed right away makes no sense. In theory, you could do it, but then you'd have to do another title search prior to close, but then it's not a condition of the purchase and sale. All in all, it's just a stupid thing to ask for, and there's no nice way of saying that. And the fact that you've got an agent saying we, like, is this person split personality?
Yes, I will say reference we when I'm speaking with my clients. We need to look after this. We need to make sure the electricity has...
But you're referring to them and
correct,
you.
Correct, correct.
This agent's making a representation that we've decided we want the title search done right away, regardless of absolute common sense of why you wouldn't do that.
I agree along with you. I'm just referencing, that's the only time I use we because we're working as a team. However, when I'm speaking with another realtor, and we're putting it together, you know, all the loose ends or coming to an agreement, I do refer to the vendor or seller as this is the seller's wishes. This is what how the seller would like to proceed. This is how the seller is responding, because it's not, I'm not a we with them at that point.
Well, you can just imagine a lawyer saying, well, we've decided that we didn't commit the murder.
Yes.
We've decided that we didn't steal that car and drive it into a gas station. It's nothing to do with you. It's all when an agent or a broker or lawyer is representing somebody, they're acting with under the instructions of the principal or the client, in this case, the owner of the property. If the owner of the property wanted the title search done right away, a good question would be, why would they want to do that? Would they buy a property doing the same thing? Would they buy a property and remove the title search 2 days after the purchase and sale? Probably not. Rant over.
Yeah.
Talk to me about hiring a friend.
Yes, hiring a friend. Many will feel that they need to hire a family member or friend. Now, I will say, on being inside the business, usually your family members are the hardest people to convince to work with you, because they don't want to be the guinea pig, if you will, and have you practice on them. So they just play kind of ignorant and, oh, I forgot all about that. Yes, I already contacted a realtor. So it can be a really difficult person to convince. However, in this story,
that. I'm lost.
Are you lost, Michael?
You completely lost.
In the industry, I know many agents that say my family members are typically the last people that will end up using me. I don't understand what you don't understand about
that. I've never seen that happen on the island.
It's all the time.
On the island, the first person they'll hire is a family member, in my experience.
Maybe those are the people that you've crossed paths with. But I know even at my office, I can name off three right off the top of my head whose family members needed to feel that they had proven themselves as a realtor before they'd hire them. For the point of this story, there was and it's somebody's sphere, not a family member, that was going to be listing a property. And I guess this, in her sphere of influence, this individual who was going to list their property paths crossed with somebody else who was a friend of theirs. And this friend ended up saying to this prospective seller that, trying to convince, obviously trying to get the listing at the end of the day, I will keep an eye out for buyers. And this seller felt so empowered and satisfied that this agent is already going to work for me because they're going to keep an eye out for buyers. So therefore, they will not enter into a contractual agreement with the person who has actually been working and helping them prepare their property for sale. That situation, when you have a realtor saying they're either going to keep an eye out for a buyer or that they have a buyer, I ask you, if you are a seller listening to this, who is that agent at the end of the day representing? And where is that price going to be in favor of? Are they going to price the property at the end of the day for the buyer? Are they going to price the property for the seller? Or are they going to play the almighty and say, this is the number for both parties, which that would be considered limited dual agency and we're not allowed to do?
Well, you're going down a completely different rabbit trail now, but you know, this is just a George Carlin skit. I'm going to keep an eye out. How long was this property on the market before?
It hasn't been on the market.
So their whole marketing program is some agent keeping an eye out.
Now they're going to slow down the process, thinking that it will be easier if this particular friend ends up discovering or finding a buyer. That's what they're going to hold out for, versus listing it, having an attractive marketing representation for their property on the market with over 500 plus realtors on Prince Edward Island, all who typically work with on average 5 to 7 buyers to get a maximum exposure. They're putting all their eggs in one basket and hoping this friend who's out looking for a buyer, and I don't know where they're standing to find this buyer, but hoping that this is what's going to end up happening and getting them maybe the most amount of money for their property.
So the vendors just need a lot of education as to the value of having their property listed with a good agent and brokerage. That's really the bottom line.
And it does require education, but some people are willing to see the whole picture and how they're playing with their biggest, usually investment, which is the equity that they have within their home. They should make sure that who they have representing them is representing them and not the buyer. And it's going to do the job right.
All I can say is wow. Leases. We've talked about leases before, but leases can become even more important when you lease a house or apartment or duplex or whatever it may be to what you feel is a wonderful woman with kids that's supporting her and her children alone. And then next thing you know, the boyfriend pops out of the woodwork and his name's not even on the lease. And then the relationship becomes problematic between you and someone you didn't even lease the property to. The moral of the story is if you're going to write up a lease, which you should do and probably have a lawyer either write it or review it, I would stipulate that you would have an occupancy clause in there that would be subject to any rules that IRAC, Island Regulatory Appeals Commission, has, and make sure that if there is somebody else moving into that structure that you're made aware of it, and there may be consequences for that. And I would also stipulate who ultimately would be responsible for that property if you have people moving in that haven't signed off on the lease to begin with.
Yeah, it just feels like a breach of contract. If I were to be the landlord, and this is who I agreed to rent my property to, and now the occupancy list has increased, which means additional wear and tear on my property, as well as, and depending if you have utilities included or services like that, I would like to be able to feel confident if they've breached the contract or they've altered it in any way, it is tight where I can evict them should that be the situation or what needs to be done.
Well, this is a particular case without getting in any details where the boyfriend is asking for information and he's not even on the lease. Up until this point, no one knew he existed. So make sure your lease is tight. Have a lawyer review it and or write it. And the other thing I would suggest, or what I would do personally, is have a property manager rent it out, because I want a credit check and a records check done as well, because you just never know. The nicest, sweetest people renting properties sometimes turn into the largest nightmares, I've learned from experience more than once.
Yes.
What about you?
Do your due diligence. I would completely agree along with you. You can get some great tenants, but you can also get some great nightmares.
Rental cottages that are for sale, and that, you know, we're just talking about a person or people selling a cottage. This cottage is rented out weekly or daily through Airbnb, Cottage Link, or whatever. When you go to list that cottage, if it's being ran as a business, number one, you want to talk to your accountant to make sure HST does not or does apply, so you're aware of that since you've turned it into a commercial entity. And the other thing is, we want a lot more documents because we're going to be asked for these documents. What documents should we have?
The profit and loss for the cottage business. The banks are going to be requesting that for the purchaser's financing. The future bookings, they're going to want to know how many weeks are being booked. What is the, basically like a rent roll, what's the amounts that you're renting out the cottage for? What are the, and again, expenses in that? Do you have cleaning staff? Is this an owner ran business, to make sure that you have a clear understanding of what to expect for the expenses and who, if you're going to be hiring somebody, right now the books look one way, but if you're hiring cleaning staff or someone to do the turnover, obviously the numbers are going to look differently. And management company, just to make sure that, are they going to be managing your bookings? Are, you know, the online platform, the name, perhaps the name of the cottage business is
website.
The website. There's a lot involved if you're able to, and again, entering into a contractual agreement, which I know this isn't necessarily what this particular question you asked me, Michael, is, but if you're writing an offer, do you get the list of perhaps reoccurring customers, vacationers that have stayed at the cottage so that you can continue to reach out to them to keep a rapport, introduce yourself as the new owner, let them know that maybe you'll do a little promotion just to keep your numbers up and repeat business, and that the seller is going to continue to reserve and book for that season, upcoming season, so that closing date doesn't come and your first season in, you have no bookings.
Or in the contract, you've just killed all those bookings and you're reverting it back to a single use cottage for you and your family, and you're no longer running it as a business.
Correct.
The bottom line is, if you're buying a cottage that is being run as a business, HST may or may not be applicable, and you want all the documents that would accompany any business that would be for sale.
Yeah. And
that's it. We're moving along.
Well, I think this is important. No realtor, as per our code and our agreements that we have our clients sell, are to give financial, legal, or accounting advice. So you can ask, and the best that I could do, you could do, Michael, or another realtor could give you maybe their experience, but we are not to be that person that gives you, you know, again, financial, legal, or environmental advice.
Unless that agent was an environmental, legal, or accounting expert, but then it would enter into a conflict of interest as well, because you're advising somebody on the purchase and at the same time you're advising them on other things. Moving along here, getting hold of an agent fast. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and one of the things they did is they contacted three agents, and they wanted to see, out of these three, who was going to answer their phone. Out of these three, none of them did, and I can certainly understand why. Many years ago, when my phone rang, I always picked it up because I realized that might be a client. Didn't matter when they called, I picked up that phone. But within the past decade, probably, and you can tell me your thoughts on this, it just seems like every second phone call is Google, or it's Microsoft, or it's someone trying to get a donation out of you. And it's not even the people that are looking for their donation. They've hired companies to solicit for donations, or it's advertising. It just, the list goes on and on and on. This subject is about how to get a hold of an agent quickly. How do we do that in today's world? And are you finding you're getting inundated by nonsense phone calls all day long?
And on top of, yes, I am being inundated on a weekly basis, many, many phone calls, either soliciting or, and you have to wonder, are they recording my voice, because they sit there quiet and then they hang up. And it does kind of spook you when you think people are stealing your voice, and because I've already had a couple of those calls.
How do we get a hold of an agent fast?
Yes, those are the things that I've experienced. How to get a hold of an agent fast would be probably to text message them, would be my opinion.
If you want to get a hold of an agent fast, because we just got to wrap this up soon because we're getting over our time limit, text them. Put your friggin' name in there. How many times do you get a text? I'm looking for information. Put your name. Who are you? What are you looking for? Just give us something so we can call back. We can do some research before we call you back, and we're just not picking up the phone and playing phone roulette, hoping that there's someone at the other end that wants our services.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I would still say make a phone call, but I would follow the phone call up with a text message. Most of us are able to respond to text messages. And yes, let us know what property so we can have it up on our computer screen or on her phone and be able to answer the questions more efficiency and with some confidence.
That's it.
That's it.
Sorry to rush you along there, but we're trying to keep this under 35.
Yes, we're doing that for our listeners to make sure that these aren't painful to listen to if you know you've got a book 45 minutes.
Well, you've heard those podcasts before that are like 2.5 hours long. And at the 2.5 hours, you're thinking, I got 20 minutes of information out of blah, blah, blah.
I agree. So thank you for listening to the Michael and Patty Show, otherwise known as MAPS, the Prince Edward Island podcast that helps guide and navigate you through the buying and selling process and everything at Prince Edward Island that seems to come into our conversations. We appreciate every single one of you for tuning in, downloading our podcast, and hopefully educating yourself from some of our experiences and stories.
And if you found this helpful, entertaining, or maybe even irritating, be sure to follow the podcast, give us some feedback, and give us a 5-star rating. Thanks for listening. Everybody have a great day.
Have a great day.